Join the Pop Life Podcast conversation. Follow us on Twitter at the Pop Life Podcast. Find us on iTunes at the Pop Life Podcast. Be sure to rate us, please, and find us on SoundCloud and share and like and subscribe. Thanks.
Welcome to the Pop Life Podcast, coming to you from the Crosby Collective Studio, starring your hosts, Jeffrey Sledge, Naima Cochran, and Sean Young. If it's top of mind in pop culture, it's up for discussion. Thank you for joining us this week. The Pop Life begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, Pop Life Podcast. Today is June. I'm going to say like the 12th.
The 10th.
I don't know what day it is now. Since the COVID hit, nigga, I barely know what month it is. Shit. What the hell's going on out here? How y'all doing?
I'm doing, man. This week has definitely been better. Better doesn't sound like the right word, but you know, last week, as we all know, was incredibly intense. One of the most intense weeks I can think of in recent history. This week feels less like a powder keg, but it's still, I'm encouraged to see that people, that last week wasn't like Black Lives Matter Fest, where everybody was like, I'm going to come out for a week.
It didn't bounce.
And I'm going to go home and chill. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And I have to say, you know, not to get all religified up in here, but God's timing is always special, because had this shit not happened during COVID, I think part of the reason we saw the protests spread so widely and so many people engaged was, A, because people wanted to get out of the house, right?
Yeah.
They missed a sense of community. But also, without the distraction and the fatigue of like going into the office every day and doing this and that, like there was more bandwidth and room to actually pay attention to this shit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, listen, Reverend Al said yesterday in the funeral that, like, it was a very preacher thing to say, but I think there's some merit in it. If George Floyd had been, you know, an athlete, we would have said it was about his, or an entertainer, we would have said this was about his stardom. If he had been a millionaire, we would have said it was about his money. But, you know, he was a regular man from Third Ward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he might be like a real catalyst in the way that like a Mike Brown was or a Trayvon was. You know, I have never seen this kind of sustained momentum, even though some of it is performative, but there's a lot of real authentic, like, yeah. How can we do better happening right now, you know?
I mean, I think you're right. I think it was, for lack of a better term, was a perfect storm. And not, obviously, that's in no way to trivialize what happened to George Floyd, because
right. That
shit is the most heinous shit ever. But like you said, the fact that people were out of work, so you could go to a march on a Tuesday afternoon.
Right.
Yeah, nothing else to do. You know, it's like, you know, kids are pretty much out of school, so they could participate as well. And what happened is, I think one of the things I haven't kind of seen fully, investigated or whatever, is because of these swells of large crowds, you know, Black and white kids, people, I should say, not just kids, just Black people, brown people, white people, everybody kind of swelling. What the cops did, the cops actually, and, you know, Goof and Bunker Boy, help to propel it even further and bigger because of their aggression to the crowd, and the aggression even when, you know, Trayvon and Mike Brown and some others died, also Sterling died, those marches were mostly Black people with some white people stuck in. These marches was everybody. So then when the cops went ham, white people were seeing Black people get beat up. So it was very easy for a lot of white people to say, as they always say, well, what did they do to egg the cops on?
It's right.
They should have complied. They should have blah, blah, blah. Now we're watching cops beat the hell out of white kids. And white.
So now it's a different game.
Exactly, because now white people are like, wait a minute. they that's my daughter. That's my son. That's my cousin. That's my grandfather. And they beating the shit out of them. And then Bunker Boy.
And doing it unprovoked, the same way we say.
Exactly. Unprovoked, just because, like when somebody's walking down the street and the cop pulls his baton out and starts swinging. So I think the cops underestimated the blowback of them, you know, doing the shit that they always did to us to everybody else. I think that's another thing that kind of has spurned this thing on, and people starting to realize, finally, wow, they weren't lying. They really do
just be out of control.
Exactly.
And the cops legit are like, because they take the protest, which it is in part or in large, the protest as a direct protest against them.
Mm-hmm.
The cops, I think what people aren't realizing, or maybe they are realizing, but what we're seeing is not cops who are out there to actually just patrol the protest and keep peace who are acting unprovoked. It's cops who are going out there to counter protest.
Yeah, they look
in their own way, right?
Yeah.
Like they're going out there because it's like they're offended and it's like, yeah, how fucking dare you? So it's personal. So it almost is like, it actually is, in and of itself, it's a poor exercise to actually have police monitor police protests, right? Like, of course they're gonna, because they still technically have the upper hand,
yeah,
and they feel away. So like, you know, you see videos, like there was one video of a cop and he was standing online and he was like rocking back and forth. He was just waiting,
ready
like
to go.
Like, give me a reason to fucking fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he was excited. Like, you know, like he was like in a box, you know, in a stance, ready to, mm-hmm, go. And that's how a lot of them feel. And you're even seeing like senior brass, because you can tell because they have on like the white shirt or the whatever. Mm-hmm. Like even they fucking people up. It's like,
yeah.
On camera, don't care.
Well, that's because
press, media, whatever.
They ain't had no action in like 10 years. So this is back to the good old days, back when you can crack a motherfucker head on a C train. And it was no problem.
It keep it pushing.
Before phones.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is what we've always talked about. And this is, we're not going to single out the NYPD. What we see is a culture of police who are, for the first time in my lifetime, really having their feet held to the fire. And they cannot tolerate accountability. They have used a union to legislate accountability out of their job. This is why you see them reacting and behaving in this way, because they are so used to not having to deal with any repercussions of this behavior.
Yep. They don't even know what to do. They're like stunned. Like you saw that the New York Pete, the
NYPD. Run them over.
Yeah.
Yeah,
So the guy, the NYPD guy, which is crazy, like it was so bizarre to hear him do that rant and not really hear how ironic.
He sounds like us.
Sounds like us. Like, dude.
The cognitive dissonance is so real with these motherfuckers.
Yeah. It was amazing.
It wasn't surprising to me at all. They have always and consistently operated in a us versus them mentality.
Yep.
Anyone who does not comply, whether it is a civilian on the street, whether it is a mayor in office, whether it is a city councilman, whoever is not in lockstep with their opinion and their view on how they do their job, they are now the enemy.
That's the enemy.
This is why you see Pat Lynch behave in such a boorish and ridiculous, depraved sort of way when he talks about the mayor. Right. And we know that this is all a bit of showmanship. Right. This is all for them to sort of curry favor. And they know that he's not a popular mayor. They know he is very easy to take pot shots at. Right. He's very easy to dislike. And so they're latching on to that.
Yeah.
And really what you see is what I've always said is culture is always top down. There is no company culture. There is no institutional structure culture that is not top down. The reason banks deny you loans is because presidents of those banks have been okay with you being denied loans.
Yep.
That is not a rogue individual making that assessment.
Yeah.
Okay. The reason that these police are acting like that is because that is how they were taught. That is the function of unions. They go in, they protect them when they don't do things. And listen, every now and again, a union will serve someone up. Take the Asian guy and the Akai girl.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Every now and again, the union will serve someone up.
Yeah.
You know, and listen, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, but Ken Thompson, he really kind of gave that kid, man, I don't want to say kid, that was a grown man. he gave that officer a pass ultimately.
Absolutely.
And we know that, again, that was the politics currying favor. That was him trying to signal to the brass and the union representative that, hey, if you just admit it, right, like, I'm not gonna wild out on you.
Yeah,
meanwhile, yeah. we've seen how we are not just treated, but how we're sentenced, how we're handled, and all of those sorts of things. And listen, these guys are gonna skate, and they come out with these stories of, oh, these people are leaving, basically trying to paint the picture that cops are retiring in the droves to try and basically scare you. But they're trying to use.
Meanwhile, it's like 2% of the NYC.
It's literally
NYC, like,
ain't gonna be no cops on the street. Oh my God.
Yeah, nigga, it was like, yo. That, ain't nobody, that, them people, that's how many people probably call out to work every day. Like, it's like nobody
that was
knows
the now. People that was on the books to get their paperwork in.
Right. Yeah.
What are we talking about here? Five to six people. Listen, if you're telling me 5 to 6 people in a fucking podunk town with 150, officers, if that's happening, yes, then that probably is something to raise a concern. A unit with 36,000 officers, like, dude.
And they're talking about 300 to 800, which, first of all, is a huge gap, right? So, like,
yeah, that's a massive, if you got like a 500 person swing.
Yeah. So, like, but either way, it's still not more than 3% of the force. And that's just the.
That's like a nigga. That's,
and that's the officers. Like, there's 20,000 more civilians in the force. Like, it's a massive body of people.
That's like having a party. But what time is starting? Either 7
or 11:30.
Yeah. come borrow money. I need to, let me hold 100 or like $700. What? What? You gotta pick one, nigga.
Right.
Yeah. And also on last Saturday, the weather actually been really nice pretty much every day lately. But last Saturday was gorgeous, and I was coming home from riding my bike, and I was like, I don't know how they're gonna push this curfew today, because like Harlem and Washington Heights was on fire. Like, everybody, it was nice outside. Everybody's on the corners. It's, it doesn't get dark late now. I'm like, how are they going to do this 8 o'clock shit? And that was when they had, it really went left because people were outside. I saw a white dude got arrested for sitting on the steps of his building. They're arresting, like, medical workers. They're arresting bike delivery people. And there was a rally in the Bronx, and the people were cleaning up. The rally, I think, ended at like 7. But the people were just kind of cleaning up. And like literally 8:01, the cops came in there swinging, grabbing people, knocking people down. So that's the night that de Blasio ended the curfew. And you notice since the curfew and stuff has ended, and the military, the National Guard has pulled out of a lot of places, we ain't been hearing nothing about no violence no more.
I think it's a couple of things.
I'm not saying there's no violence, period. But
right. No, but I think it's a few things. I think that the looting on a whole has calmed down because people were getting hip to it and starting to spot the agitators, people.
Yeah.
And I actually think that the military violence and the curfew was lending itself to that, because you're keeping people like sectioned off in certain areas, and they got to get out of certain places. And I think it was actually adding to kind of like flash mob behavior. But also, one reason de Blasio kind of had to lift the curfew is that New York started our first phase of reopening yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, Monday.
Yeah,
so
Monday.
Like, how you going to do that when niggas got to be in the house before the sun goes down? You know what I mean? Like, you gotta, if you really want to try to return us to some sense of normalcy, like, that has to be part of it.
Yeah, again, I agree with everything you're saying. And you said on the weekends, at Sunday night, Saturday night, like, you want people to run home by 8 o'clock. That's not real. Especially with people, we've been cooped up in the house since March. This is not realistic. So, I'm happy to see the violence going down. But I'm hoping and praying that the intensity keeps going. It's a lot of changes. They took the show Cops off the air. It took Going with the Wind off the air. I don't know if they really.
Both of which are hilarious. I could give a fuck about either. Because also on Cops, most of the people on Cops is like crazy white people. So
I didn't know Cops was even still on.
I didn't know it was still on either, to be honest with you.
You know what I'm saying?
Well, Cops came back. Cops was, yes. Okay. So it was rebooted, I believe, in like 2012 or 2013, and it kind of went to Spike. I don't even know if Spike still exists, but Spike initially.
Yeah, is Spike TV still around?
Spike was basically like it was the frat boys' channel.
Yes.
Right? Like you can go watch UFC, mm-hmm. you can watch like this weird ass towing show that they used to have on there. You know what I'm saying? Where they would like get into these fake fights and shit like that.
Okay.
they'd have a bunch of, think of Maury. You know, Maury meets Springer.
Oh wait, was like that the show with the black with girl?
Black girl, yeah.
The girl with the fire extinguisher.
Yes. All of that sort of stuff. Yeah, okay. So yes, they brought Cops back. It's an easy show. And it had a successful run. The show was like this 30 years old. You know,
and it probably cost $6 to make.
a little piece of change.
Nothing. So yeah, and there's been some statues coming down, slaveholders and stuff. So there's been some symbolic things happening. Now you want to talk a little bit about Nancy and them with the kente cloth?
Lord Jesus. So here's the thing. Here's the thing about Nancy.
You have to help Nancy up.
Nancy and Democratic members of the House. Yeah. Did a moment of silence in honor of George.
They did 8:46. They did 8:46.
They did the whole 8:46 minutes.
I was surprised some of them could stay on their knee. That's kneeling. A long time.
One person didn't. And they old.
Jerry Nadler did.
Yeah, because I think he had like a hip or a knee.
Yeah, Nancy is 80. I think Chuck is sniffing 80. Like that's a long.
Yeah,
time.
they ain't young. And I think I was about to say John Lewis. Yeah. Wait, no, John Lewis
didn't pass. He's in the hospital room.
Okay. I thought I saw him in, never mind. I thought I saw him in D.C. over the weekend. Okay, never mind. Are you sure he's still in the hospital?
Well, I don't know. I know he's battling cancer. Maybe he came out for a month.
I thought it was him standing
you know what I just said? Because he had a mask.
Because he had the mask on, right.
Yeah,
so, anyway. So, I was about to say, so they did, the 8 minutes for a 6 second of silence in honor of George Floyd, but they did it each draped with a kente cloth, what do you call it, a mantle?
Stole, they call
stole,
it.
Stole, whatever you call it, stole.
I call it a scarf.
So it looked very performative, right? The optics were very performative. However, the spirit behind it actually wasn't that. Apparently, those members were gifted those stoles on a trip to Ghana to symbolize the connection between Ghana and the U.S. as like a promised alliance and partnership, etc. But we ain't know that.
No, we ain't know none of that.
We ain't know that.
We thought that got him down to Miss Mamie's.
Right, and like handed him out that morning. You know what I'm saying?
The first thing I said was, nigga, they got them from somebody church from the choir anniversary.
From the choir for Black History, from the Black History Month program.
I know the choir sessions when I see them.
Exactly.
Because we all our choirs got, that's when we do like the African ensemble.
Exactly. And then Nancy had on a red suit, so people were saying it was
she like
was
a Delta.
The Delta Founders Day. Oh, man.
But we didn't know that. And they also did actually, they also did actually enact some legislation in the House.
Yeah, I was going to say that. The legislation they enacted is actually great legislation. And Twitter, we're going to have the jokes. You know, it was jokes. We need these jokes in today's world. You know what I'm saying? And, we need these jokes. That's all. Thank you for the legislation, but shit was funny. I wanted to talk also about, bro, you want to take on Drew Brees?
I mean, I can.
I mean, it's only right.
So Saints quarterback Drew Brees, unless you've been under a rock, he made some very ridiculous statements on an interview with Yahoo News.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Yahoo Finance. Basically doing what many white, established white men often do, which is kind of go on autopilot about the flag. And he rambles on about how he wouldn't be okay with anyone disrespecting the flag and all of these things. And this was kind of in response to a question that was really kind of posed broadly.
Yeah.
And was asked, you know, hey, how would you react to any protests?
And anybody kneeling when
yes.
the season starts.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think the guy even specified kneeling. He just said protest. That's the kind of the weird point, right? Is that the guy really threw out a very broad question.
Yeah.
And again, he goes on autopilot. He starts talking about his grandfather's in the war and all of that. And, you know, listen, he got immediate backlash.
Immediate from teammates.
And he got fired up pretty easily and pretty quick. And I was very surprised and happily surprised to see teammates and fellow players really kind of check him. Now, I will say, you know, this is not in defense of Drew Brees because I'm a Saints fan, but I will say some things that might seem like it's defending him. But he has been involved in that community. He's not a fly-by-night guy in the community.
Yeah.
I think that this is going to hurt him, ultimately. This will always kind of come up. And, you know, is that fair? I mean, maybe it is. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not here. Drew Brees is a middle-aged white man who is a multimillionaire. He is literally the last person on earth that needs defending.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm not here to kind of defend him. He's going to be fine. You know, Donald Trump, you know, tweeted out some things to him, and Drew Brees was really quick to kind of jump off that train.
Yeah.
And I think he recognized that, you know, he had gone a step too far in his response. Mm-hmm. And, you know, do I think he, you know, listen, I don't think, I've never thought that he was some, you know, cross-burning racist.
No.
But I also, you know, when people hit me, they were like, yo, your boy. I'm like, you know, I don't have expectations on athletes, bro. Like, I'm an all-the-way grown-ass man, my nigga. Like we watch terrible people do great shit on Sunday mm-hmm. all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a horse in a race on some moral high ground.
Yeah, I think athletes are the most, like, we talk about entertainers and wealthy people living in a bubble, but I think athletes live in the biggest bubble because they have been protected, taken care of, shielded, and only around each other like their entire lives. From the time they were kids,
literally when you
Pee Wee League, you know what I mean? Like,
you start to separate about 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Between 11 and 12 is where you really start to see the physical gap. That's usually when kids get their growth spurts.
Yeah.
And you start to see A teams versus B teams. This is no longer just about, you know, us having fun, but they're really keeping score. You know, you're working out, you're practicing in a different way. So, yes, they do operate in a bubble. And Drew Brees has been a hell of an athlete. You know what I'm saying? But I also have never looked for a white man I've never had the expectations of that guy to be, you know, to defend me because he is also, we're still talking about Louisiana, like, sure. Mm-hmm. You know, New Orleans is a very black place. Okay. And once you start getting outside of,
yeah, I say, that, drive 20 miles outside of New Orleans.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nigga, you back down south. Back down.
It's sundown towns and all. And yeah,
all man, that so, shit. All that shit. So, I know. Shannon Sharp had a, I don't know if you saw him, he had a an interesting take on it. Because Drew actually called him.
And I did.
Sort of, right. Shannon said something that I think that a lot of us were thinking but didn't say. And he said he's sure the teammates thought that was because Drew has been so embedded in the community and did so much. And, you know, they said New Orleans is one of the blackest cities in the country. And Drew has done so much there and lives there, lives in the city, you know, be moving around, not going to the club or nothing, but like he's running a Drew somewhere, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You might see Drew's wife in the Whole Foods, like they're in the community. When Katrina happened, he was, you know, in it. So Shannon was almost like, Drew, like, not you, like anybody, yeah. Like we thought, Shannon was like pretty much any other quarterback, with a white quarterback, we would have been like, well, you know, because Tom Brady, I'm kind of, you know, he didn't say Tom Brady, I'm saying that, but
yeah,
like, you know, I kind of, I'm not surprised that, you know, that one said, but he's like, not Drew, like, you've been so embedded in that black community, and it kind of like,
I think maybe we overestimated. Yes, what we overestimate is that there are people who are going to be involved in the community. They're going to work with black folks. They're going to assist people of color and black folks in particular. Mm-hmm. They are also going to sit with Donald Trump and take pictures with him. And yeah. Until we start to understand that, you know, we always talk about that saying, you know your white folks. You mm-hmm. know, I don't put I have a handful. I literally have a handful of white folks that I've come across in my life that it would fuck me up
if they went.
If I found out that they were like racist or they you know, I just don't have those expectations. And to be fair, there are fairly a solid amount of black folks that have. You know, have those same views and operate in those same ways. And they may not say it in that same way,
mm-hmm.
right.
but you know, they operate. We all talked about that, how conservative people are so embedded in, and so, you know, they were against this whole thing.
Yeah.
I think also what's important to note is that white people having proximity to blackness also sometimes makes them feel like they're more qualified to tell us what the fuck we should and shouldn't be doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they have white savior syndrome, or kind of like, you know, especially I have to imagine with Drew, he probably comes into contact with, aside from his players' families, probably like, you know, a poorer, more economically challenged part of the population more often, like if he's doing meet and greets and community stuff and all that other stuff. So he's probably very much feeling like, yo, you know, He might feel like he's an authority, because I even noticed when he made his apology, he said something about being a leader in the black community. And I'm like, who the fuck asked Joe ass to be a leader in the black community?
He's kind of done that to some degree by default, because he has been the face of that franchise. It isn't because anyone asked him or anything like that. But I also think that this is also where. When we talk, you know, kind of last week about having a level of deference and not being so tone deaf, right? This is probably the point where you should be really talking to grassroots people in this community. I'm not even suggesting you're a teammate, because they're not always.
Yeah, I'm talking about go back to the community center and talk to the person.
Yeah,
George, you run the community center.
You have to be connected to those people in order to get a full picture. But again, what he said, listen, was it the end of the world? No, it wasn't. We've heard it all before. Yeah. Nothing he said was new. It sounded like a recorded message. He rattled off all of that, you know, bullshit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even want to say it came off. It was insensitive. It was tone deaf. And it was completely out of line and completely out of pocket. And he deserves all the smoke he's going to get. So anybody coming to his defense, like, you could sit this one out. Okay, Drew is not going to be missing any meals. Ain't nobody going to be sharing a bedroom at the Breeze house no time soon. Okay, relax.
Only thing I don't like about what he said, and it's not him specifically, but this is what I've heard since this whole since Kaepernick started doing the kneeling thing, I've heard so many white folks say what he said, which is, my grandfather was in the military, my father served in Vietnam. I'm like, yo, man, why y'all keep acting like no black people who served people's family in military too? My father was in the Navy. So what the fuck is you saying, B?
Yeah.
When my father came home, his experience wasn't what your father's was. So cut the bullshit. And they try to put an ownership on the military being like theirs, like my grandfather was in World War II.
Because what it does is the same thing we talked about with the cops. It cloaks them in this ability to be beyond reproach, right? Yeah. It means
like
that
invincibility, like I'm coming in flag.
Yes, yes, yeah. It drapes them in this hero porn type shit that they all fetishize about, like being, you know, these superheroes and My dad was, okay. Like, he wasn't the only one who went to war, bro. Like,
exactly, you know? Exactly. That's my point. He wasn't the only one that was over there. And trust me, there was a whole lot of blacks, Asians, Latino, you know, Native Americans. A whole lot of everybody served in the military. You know, and we're not even speaking on all the women. Like, what you saying, fam? Like, that don't move the needle to me in the least bit. I hate that shit that they kind of run with that, like, you know, well, hey, you know, I did it, so my grandfather did it, so I'm, like you said, so I'm entitled to do whatever the fuck I want to do. I don't like that shit at all, man. I just wanted to mention a guy named Charles, what is his name? Charles Q. Brown has become the head of the Air Force. First black person to be the head of
The first black.
Yeah, it's the first military branch head, of the Air Force, rather, ever. You know what I'm saying? As far as back as the Air Force goes, he's the first one. Bro got a little squeeze on his face. But I just wanted to kind of, you know, give him a shout out. He did a little thing yesterday talking about, you know, his path, I guess, and how it's been tough and how it's hard for him to be the only, you know, black man in the room, and how he feels sometimes disconnected from his people, and, you know, how he can try to do better, and, you know, whatever. But you guys need to say, bro, he's going to move on.
You know, God bless him. I'm sure he's worked very hard and has probably been been qualified to do this job for a long time. Mm-hmm. I will say, you know, I don't want to say this in any disparaging way, but from what I've always understood is that the Air Force is kind of looked at as the, you know, sort of lower rung.
The lesser of, they're not the Marines and Army.
Not at all. Like, it's like they are number four, and they're like right above the Coast Guard, you know, in terms of prestige.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it's not lost on me that this is where they're starting to sort of give a qualified man his due. When I am 100% positive that man has been qualified for a very long time.
I'm sure he has.
And, you know, this obviously it's no disrespect to him because I can't fly a fucking drone, let alone, you know what I'm saying? Let alone, you know, on and on the aircraft carrier. So, you know, God bless him. I wish him well. I hope he understands, you know, that, you know, people are going to be coming for his neck. And that's part of the game.
Absolutely. Mentioned a couple of TV shows. I've been watching. I haven't finished it yet. I got a couple episodes to go. There's a show on Netflix called Blood and Water. It's really interesting. It's South African. It's a black about this black girl and her family, and it's she's kind of trying to solve this mystery about this missing sister that she has. But so it's kind of like that, a little bit of the mystery thing, and like her trying to almost be like a detective in a way. She's a kid. She's like in high school, but mixed with like, I guess, the South African version of like a 90210 or something. Like, so it's got like this kind of like high school stuff going on too. It's good. The episodes aren't that long. They're like, you know, 40 minutes. There's only like five of them, so you can breeze through it pretty quick, but it's kind of interesting. And then I wanted to mention I May Destroy You. I don't know if either one of y'all saw
Michaela Cole. I haven't watched it yet. I heard it's good, though. And I fuck with Michaela Cole. I really like chewing gum, so I'm interested to see that.
Yeah. Did you see it, bro?
Nah, I ain't see it. I mean, I saw the preview for it, and I'm going to watch it. I just haven't seen it.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. Like, the first episode, it's a bit confusing in a way, but it's, you know, only a half hour, so it's like it's flying. And so the prep of the first episode, obviously things are going to unfold, I'm sure, and there'll be a whole lot of different twists. But the premise of the first episode is, it's kind of like they've taken like a little bit of like Black Mirror and also like a London version of Insecure and like put them together. Cause Michaela plays a young girl who's like a writer. She's got a TV show and became very successful. And now she's kind of figuring out what to do next, but she's like a cokehead. she in the street, she partying hard with like all her people's, love the black cats in London, they getting it in, you know, but then something happens to her and she can't remember what happened. So it's her trying to kind of figure out like what happened that night. And it looks like in this flashes of her being date raped. And apparently it's based on something that actually happened to her for real when during the chewing gum run. Well, she like went out one night, somebody spiked her, some dude spiked her drink and like date raped her in a bathroom. So it's wow. really, yeah, it's kind of, yeah. So it's really, so you're kind of getting glimpses of, again, like how Insecure gives us glimpses of kind of like, you know, that upwardly mobile black crew in LA, you know, the kind of like the restaurants they go to, the things they like to do. We're getting that like the first episode, we're kind of getting that the London version. Like they meet at this like rooftop spot and it's dope and it's her and her friend, a couple of people, well, not Michaela, but it's her friend we meet during the show and he's trying to have a threesome with his wife. And it's like a lot of shit. It's a lot of shit coming at you. But I really, really enjoyed it. Because I fuck with Michaela anyway, heavy. So I'm going to definitely see this one too. So I recommend that if you haven't watched that. And then I wanted to talk about Insecure, which I know you niggas ain't watch. But it's episode 9. It was really good this week.
Poor Jeff been having to recap Insecure by his goddamn self every week. While we be answering emails.
While I'm doing this, bruh and Naima, not even looking at me. They like, nigga, I don't exist.
We got head down.
All they doing is listening to when I stop talking. That's all they want to do. They don't even listen to what I'm saying.
It's like when you listen for the pause, so you be like, word?
Oh, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
This should be called the That's Crazy segment, because that's exactly what that is. So it was really good. People say it's maybe their favorite episode of the season. There was a clash between Issa and Molly, like basically the friendship, they fell apart after trying to fix it. Next week is episode 10, which is the last episode of the season. Big finale. Don't kind of know where this is going. Don't know who Issa's going to end up with. It's going to end up with anybody. Lawrence might be moving to San Francisco. A lot of moving parts right now. So for all the listeners who do watch the show, you know what? Send me some goddamn emails so we can talk about it, because these two niggas here ain't paying no attention to me at all. They ignoring
not
me.
Not a drop. In fairness, I'm ignoring Insecure conversations on like 3 different platforms. So it's fine. Like, this is not the only place where I'm ignoring niggas talking about Insecure. It's just the only place where I'm not the only person ignoring
people talking
about Insecure.
Okay. Let's talk about Bruce Lee documentary. Did anyone else see that?
I'm gonna watch it this weekend.
Okay, I watched the second half of it because I was watching Billions. I'm locked in on Billions now.
So you know, I've never watched it, but here it's amazing. Billions is dope.
I think I told y'all niggas the white.
You did.
I started watching dope. Like maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. Started from season 1, episode 1, and I just binged.
You locked in
and caught all the way up to where now I got to watch it in real.
Yeah,
time.
I'm a season behind actually.
Okay, so yeah, I hear Beans is great. So there was a documentary called Be Water, ESPN 30 for 30, about Bruce Lee. Weirdly enough, I knew a lot of this stuff. When I was watching, I was like, I knew this. I didn't realize that I was a Bruce Lee fan like so many people were as a kid, so it wasn't, you know, shocking. And for some reason, he really tapped in to the black kids. Like niggas was walking around wearing Chinese slippers.
You know what?
Niggas love kung fu. Was it just Bruce or was it?
You know what?
Combo. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, when you watch him, as I watch him now as an older man and having an idea about entertainment and what all of those things mean, like he's fucking cool, man.
Yeah.
Like he's got a fucking presence and a swagger that is not, it's not routinely associated with Asian men now.
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
45 years ago. So there is a coolness and an aura that definitely reeks from him.
Mm-hmm.
That is part showbiz, part I can really kick your ass like for real. And then part like I'm a star.
Yes. Yes.
Right. So he had all of those. He today is competing against The Rock. today.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
He's because he also you know, he didn't, I mean, obviously he had to ham it up kind of early on in some of these things. He's putting on his, you know, the ridiculous accents and things like that. Yeah, I'm sure he, you know, didn't want to do, but that's kind of what Hollywood, you know, saw them as. And it's just really, I think that his swag and his coolness and his demeanor is what made it dope.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Let me give you a little background on that, because it's very interesting you say that, because I thought the same way. So what happened was, okay, he was born in San Francisco, but as he was like an infant, his father, whose father was an actor, his mother and father were actors in like Chinese, almost like a Chinese vaudeville, right, so in Hong Kong. So they moved back to Hong Kong, and then Bruce Lee actually was a child star in Hong Kong. He was like in movies and shit. He was like a pretty big deal. Then when he was a rough kid. Like, he used to like fight a lot and shit. So his family shipped him back to America because he was getting in so much trouble in China. They shipped him to Seattle, right? By this point, he's probably 17, 18. So he moves in with this woman who owns a restaurant, Ruby Chow's, and he's like works in the restaurant. And what does he do? He starts hanging with the brothers. he was hanging with all black kids. There's a guy in the dock. He was like, yeah, like Bruce was teaching us how to fight and shit. And he hung out with us. Like, he hung out. It was like the black cats and a couple Spanish cats. And he hung out with them. And the black cat says, we taught him how to dress, how to work, move
on the
streets here, how to talk, da da da. So I was like, that's why he moves like that. He learned it from black people, and then he, of course, incorporated his Asian culture into it as well. So all that thing you said about the cool and the swag, he got it from
us. It was effortless. You know what I'm saying? It was effortless. And you know, obviously, man, there's always been that mystery around his death. I don't think this documentary absolves. Well, I think it specifically didn't. Right, like I think it wanted to leave. Yes, I think it wanted to sort of leave this lingering hangover about his death, and mostly because I wanted it. I think they wanted it to be remembered as his story up until that point. They didn't really spend a lot of time on his death.
No, they didn't. I think
purposefully. Quick.
Yeah.
Yes, I think purposefully. He was fucking phenomenal, man. Even when you know, very rarely. There are very few people that pop on camera on from those old movies.
Yeah.
Like, when you look at, Fred Williamson and, like, Black Sea, like, you get it immediately.
Right away.
Immediately. Yeah. When you look at Bruce, it is immediate. You like, shit, this guy's a star. Like, how did no one see this?
Yeah. And the thing is, even when they show, because they show clips of the movie he was in as a kid, and you see it even then.
Yes, yes. Like, he's the precocious kid. He's the Raven Simone.
He was destined. He was destined to do this. And it was very interesting because his wife said that on their first date, he took her to a theater in Seattle to see one of his movies, but she didn't know. So she was in the movies, and she's like, "Oh shit, that's you!" And she said, "Bruce, because he grew up in a." That showbiz family, he wasn't tripping. He was like, oh, yeah, this is something I did as a kid. Like me and you talk about a summer job we had.
Yeah.
That's how he looked at it. Like, I was in a movie, a couple movies. But anyway, it's very interesting. Obviously, if you're a Bruce Lee fan, you should watch it. I don't know how much new stuff. The newest stuff revealed to me was that stuff about his childhood and about the whole thing with hanging with the brothers in Seattle and all that. And they've got a ton of old footage and a lot of old pictures and stuff that, you know, that we haven't seen him and his family. Because the other thing about Bruce Lee that people didn't know is, like, his father's brother was, like, one of the first millionaires in China. Like, he grew up rich. He grew up rich. You know what I'm saying? He had, like, maids and all that. It's crazy.
Yeah, I remember. I didn't know his uncle was a millionaire, but I always remember them talking about he didn't grow up poor. He didn't have that story.
Yeah, his poverty came, honestly, when he came back here to America, because he didn't ask his father for no money. He came over here with like $100 in his pocket and was like, I'm gonna make it. But anyway, so I wanted to mention that because I really enjoyed the doc. Nah, you want to mention the Before the 90?
Yeah, so now they got Jeff on the 90 Day Fiancé train.
I missed the second reunion, but
on Monday. The 90 Day Fiancé tell all, I'm going to explain to the audience and Jeffrey also to you since you're new. We all get really frustrated about it because Sean Robinson does not push the way she should push.
Because Sean Robinson, I mean, I like Sean's sister. It's not a disrespect, but like, I almost feel like, does she watch the show? Because I feel
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder that too. I feel like she only watches, sometimes I really feel like she only watches the clips.
Yes.
That they give her for the reunion.
She's leaving huge holes. It's like, how do you not know this or that?
I always genuinely feel like she just watches the clips mm-hmm. they give her for the reunion. And literally every year or every tell-all, everybody's complaining like, Sean, what the fuck? And one time, but what's funny is that one time somebody was in my comments like, I don't know why they don't replace Sean with a different host. And Sean responded like, because the reunion is always number one anyway, so we don't have to. And I was like, oop.
Okay, Sean. And I oop.
My bad. You know what I mean? I was like, all right, Shawty. And I oop. But to your point, she be leaving out mad follow-up questions, mad holes. Like, she ain't Andy Cohen, right? But the good thing about moving forward, the series 90 Day Fiancé Happily Ever After, is that all of those people have now been on the show for years and they know each other. So what she leaves out, they be coming at each other like, nah, but you did, blah, 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 you know. So anyway,
and they do the pillow talk thing too. So
the pillow talk thing.
So the cast members watch all the shows. They watch
right.
all the shows.
So with the tell-all though, I was missing some of what I wanted. Like the producers, I think, also are guilty of not really letting the people who should have the floor
okay.
and clear the air, right? Because like I felt like with Stephanie and Erica with the potential fake lesbian.
I feel like Stephanie
should have got called off. Erica should have had.
They should have muted Stephanie.
They should have muted Stephanie and her fucking friends. Yeah. Yeah, like, why you have her friends on there? Like, should have muted Stephanie. I don't know why the fuck Tom is there at fucking all.
Yeah.
They didn't really, I feel like they still really didn't let, like, what you call it? Ed's daughter was so nasty to Rose.
Wow.
Like,
for no reason.
For no reason. I feel like Rose still didn't talking about don't take that tone with me. She speaks Tagalog. That's how they sound. Like that's
exactly.
how they sound. and like with whom else? And with Lisa and Usman. Like Usman was so cool through this whole shit and Lisa was so fucking nasty and rude. Like with just everything, I was just like, why don't y'all make these people shut the fuck up?
I did like Real Housewives of Atlanta. This year with the reunion, because it was on Zoom, Andy would mute people.
Yeah, and that's what, like honestly, that's what either Sean or somebody, the producer, somebody should have been muting these motherfuckers. Like, but I think they were leaving people off mute on purpose. Like, Ed was being disruptive. Like, people were chiming in on folks' stories. And I was like, mm-hmm. why aren't you on mute? Like, why are you even able to talk right now? Yeah.
David jumped in on Yolanda shit, which was
fucking
Like, nigga,
which was like, really?
You're doing the same thing. You're being catfished too. Like, what is he talking about? But yeah, I mean, I haven't started any of the new one. The Other Way, I think is the one that started.
Yeah, that just started. The first episode was in. Yeah. The most interesting thing is that there's a girl who's a black girl who's an IG model and aspiring rapper who's moving to Jordan to marry her Muslim boyfriend. And that's not going to work out well at all.
That rapping shit is over with.
Yeah.
I want to mention, I forgot to talk about, did y'all watch Jeffrey Epstein?
I started it, but I stopped it.
I watched
it. I've heard it's compelling.
Yeah. So let's get into it. So, because man, I mean, for those who don't know, I'm surprised if you don't, but Jeffrey Epstein was this uber rich guy who was basically running a sex ring of teenage girls and allegedly supplying a lot of these teenage girls to high-powered politicians, entertainers, lawyers, you know, whoever had, you know, some real bread, Epstein was their guy, including the current president of the United States. I felt like, in watching this documentary on Netflix, I felt like a lot of it almost like was all sub shots at Trump. Like, whenever you out of office, we're going to lift the curtain. I feel like people who did that documentary, they know everything about what Trump was doing with Epstein. That was his man.
Interesting.
But there was some pictures of Trump and some video. They didn't accuse Trump of anything, But it was, I just felt like it was almost like, all right, bro, you're going to see. Maybe I'm reaching. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say that you're reaching, but I disagree. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think that what you're saying is like a so far fetched in terms of making that assessment, but I would disagree. And mostly here's why. Like, the insinuations of using Trump is a very easy way to move the needle, right? And sort of shake the table, right? And there has always been an underlying sense that, you know, listen, I am in no way defending, you know, 45, yeah, right? Like, he's a fucking absolute piece of shit, trash human. I don't think he was seeking out, like, fucking prepubescent girls. You know, do I think he likes some young? Sure. I think he would, you know, love a 22-year-old or, you know what I'm saying, or a 20-year-old. I don't necessarily know that, you know, he's been out here or there's a history of him, you know, being inappropriate with 13 and 14-year-olds. Because that's ultimately what we're talking about here.
We're talking about girls.
We're talking about girls under 16 years old.
Yeah, girls in like 10th grade, 11th grade.
Literally braces on their teeth, girls.
Literally. So the documentary was about Epstein, and he kind of showed like his beginnings, a little bit of his beginnings, and how he got on, and how like he was a teacher at, I think it was at Dalton?
The Dalton School, yes.
Dalton School, and got caught lying there, like, and talked his way out of it, and ended up keeping his gig. And the guy who runs Dalton was like, I wish I would have, like, you know, fired him back then. I might have stopped a lot of bullshit. The Dalton School obviously put him in touch with a lot of wealthy people. He also became a stockbroker and started getting money doing that. And then just started, you know, wilding. One of the things that blew me away, and not that I don't know this exists, but like, they really were really showing you a lot more than a lot of other, documentary stuff do that aren't, and it wasn't, I wasn't say glamorizing, you know, some like Robin Leach shit or whatever, but just like showing you how much bread this dude had. Was crazy. This dude's townhouse is on, well, was on 71st and 5th. His joint is worth like $77 million. Like your man was rolling on some. He had two planes. He had a 747. Like, so he could move around. Like, he could, like, you know, take girls down. It was showing he was like taking girls down to his joint in Palm Beach, you know, to his joint in Bahamas. Like, he was just, you know.
Well, the most shocking. Not the most shocking thing, because I kind of felt like this, but how they talked about him allegedly getting Lex Wessler's account. Because that's ultimately how he makes his money.
Yes.
He makes his money because time and time again, he is a grand liar and a master manipulator, right? Yep. And what he does is he's able to use that. He's able to use his obvious ability as a white man to sort of circumvent rules.
Yes.
He did this at the Dalton School. He does this at this at Bear Stearns, which is where I think he was.
He was lying there too.
He was lying. Yes. And so what
resume and all kind of shit. Mm-hmm.
So they basically allege that Jeffrey has access to these accounts and is managing this money because he and Wexler have a alleged sexual relationship.
Yeah. Lexi Wessler, if you don't know, is a guy who owns Victoria's Secrets. What else is he doing? The Limited,
all of those sorts of, basically all of those mall stores.
Yes.
All of those mall stores that you see. And it was never really, it was always very strange because people who operate with money like that usually have in-house people with a level of credibility and a level of pedigree that is just untarnished, right? Mm-hmm. Like you know, there's usually a guy from, you know, Wharton or, you know, Stanford or Princeton.
Yeah.
You know, those are the guys that usually kind of manages the money for those people. And so it was just very weird. And it was always very weird about the sort of stranglehold that he was able to use and have and how he had this access. And so, he is we all kind of know the deeds that Jeffrey Epstein has done. But what has also been fascinating is how the people who have participated in these things have just skated. The girlfriend of his, It's nowhere to be found.
Who was his right hand? Like, she was the right hand. She was down with all of it.
The people who were trying to expose this as early as the late 90s were bullied and pressured and threatened. We know how far his reach is based on what would happen with these young ladies.
Yep.
How they had people, he had people tailing them and private investigators, you know, just basically harassing them, which I always found strange in Florida, because I'm like, it's such an open carry, like, just the way those PIs were moving was just kind of weird. But everything that he did was kind of on brand. You can hear it from the phone calls of the people who worked for him at that house. Every single story was the same story. Without fail. You know, there was no wiggle room in those stories, whether it was the people on the island or the people in West Palm or the people in New York City.
Yep.
It was all the same.
And he would have the girls recruit other girls. So these girls, now women on the show, were like, well, one girl was like, I recruited at least like 20 or 30 girls. And those girls recruited girls. So like, it was this massive pyramid scheme of just, and the supply of these girls, like, were going to like the local high schools from Palm Beach or like a New York, like, he got one girl and then got her sister. Like, he was just like, you know, and it was always the same thing. Like Sean said, he wanted me to give him a massage, and then he turned over, and then it was like he did the same move every time, but just never got caught. It was unbelievable.
Well, I think that the recruitment was part of the process of not getting caught.
Because the girl did it, bought them, not me.
No, not just that, but because there's a turnover. So basically he's getting all of the things that he's looking for out of this, right? Without the person being consistent. So there's no consistent pattern. There's no consistent trail of money. There's no consistent behavior. It would be, you know, like they said, they would come, they might have come 3, 4, 5 times. I mean, there were two women in particular that they were older women at that point, and they had kind of did the same thing. I'm not saying that because they were older that they weren't abused or you know, manipulated and coerced, but they were older women. They were not teenagers.
Yeah.
But the teenage MO was always like a high turnover.
Yeah.
So they would come a couple times.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they keep it pushing because they would have recruited more girls.
Exactly. It was something else that blew me away was he did do I'm doing air quotes, a jail sentence before the last one was to kill himself. And that was down in Florida in Palm Beach. And so they had they talked to the lawyer who's like, you know, I'm paraphrasing things. He basically said, yo, I had him dead to rights. Like, it was over. Like, I had him, like, you know, was lit. I was, and he, and the lawyer was really, you know, dedicated to getting, you know, these girls, you know, justice because of what he had done to them. And so he had him dead to rights, and he was like, he talked and he went through the thing, and all of a sudden, no trial. And he was like, what are you talking about? No trial. What are you talking about? And it was like, well, he pleaded out. And the lawyer was like, nobody even told me. That's how much power he had in this community. So what he did was he did a jail sentence. Supposed to be, I think, 2 years. I think he did like a few months. But basically, he would leave every day for 12 hours a day. He could leave 12 hours a day and basically go do what the fuck he wanted to do. He had a guard that was supposed to be with him, but they found out later, of course, he was paying crazy bread. The guard basically was a driver.
It was his bodyguard.
His bodyguard was, but yeah, he would go to Miami and have lunch. You know what I'm saying? Like, he would take trips on a plane. Like, so his jail sentence, it was a whole separate wing of the jail. He had women coming into the jail having sex. Like, it was almost like some Goodfellas shit. He was bringing food in. Like, his jail sentence was a joke. He basically just kind of slept there at night, and then the rest of the day he lived his life. And come find out that I forget the guy's name, Alex something, who I guess was the DA on that case, was the guy that later on Trump tried to make part of his cabinet.
He made him Secretary of Labor.
Yeah, Alex.
Alex Acosta, I believe his name is.
Acosta, yes. Yeah, but then after like 2 months, because of this heat with the Epstein case, the guy he quit because of the shit was coming down on him. But like again, you just have to really watch it. I'm leaving a lot out, but like we're both leaving a lot out. But it's just interesting, basically to see like how a rich white man can do whatever the fuck he wants to do. That's really what this movie, this documentary is about. A rich ass white man, when he died, he's worth like $577. He had wild bread. Could do whatever he wants to do with literally no repercussions. And the reason he killed himself is because he was finally caught. And he was going to have to do some real time.
So wait, you believe that he killed himself? Because most of the people I know who are coming out of there saying he definitely was killed.
They say he killed himself. When I went into it, I didn't even know if he was even dead. But then they do show him them wheeling out his body. And he looks dead. In the pictures.
You thought he was hiding on an island someplace?
I absolutely did. I was like, yo, he got those type of contacts and that type of bread, which is what happened was when he got caught the last time, they rushed him on the plane. He didn't know he was coming off a trip, and they caught him, and then they took all his passports away. He offered the courts up to $500 million to bond out.
He offered all of his assets.
All of his assets, just to get out. And the courts was, for the first time, the courts was like, no, because they found, like, several passports, you know, different aliases. He had a bunch of diamonds, which I think he could have turned into cash. He had all these, like, if this dude gets out,
when he had gold bars, diamonds, everything to keep you on the run.
He was ready to go. He just got caught slipping. Like, if he had got a tip that they were coming for him, we never would have seen Epstein again. He just... For some reason, you know, it worked. But like I said, people, if you haven't watched, you should watch. It's a really good watch. I wanted to also mention the George Floyd service. Actually, I didn't see much of it.
I chimed in in the last, I guess, hour and change. And there was a Dr. Steve, is his name Wallace? Hold on.
Is that the pastor of that church?
I don't know if he's the pastor of that church, but he was a white pastor.
Okay, that's not him. Pastor of the church is black.
Yeah, no, not him. Dr. Steve Wells. So around the time I chimed in right before this white pastor, Dr. Steve Wells, took the podium and the pulpit. And the reason I'm mentioning him is because while he was up there, he took a minute to address his remarks to white churches and their, you know, their lack of voice in racial justice and their perpetuation of racism and how it conflicts with actual Christianity and the fact that they need to stand up and do more. And I was like, oh, okay, we having church for real.
Yeah, for real, here.
Yeah. And then that's why I knew his name, because I was like, who is this? Let me write that down.
is he and, from Houston?
Yeah, he's in Houston.
Okay.
And then Reverend Al eulogized him. And the thing
her eulogy was really good.
It was very good. And the thing about Al is, you know, obviously he's a legend and he's an elder and his work is extremely important, the work he's done. But even for those of us who are sometimes like, all right, Al, we ain't necessarily need you to be here for whatever to speak on our behalf, when he puts that robe on in that pulpit,
he's a real man.
Who he be preaching? Man can, let me tell you, Al can preach. The first time I saw him preach live, I was completely prepared to be underwhelmed. Completely prepared. And the way my church, like almost all churches, our choir loft is behind the pulpit.
Oh, he came to the convent.
He came to preach in convent. That was the first time I heard him preach live.
Okay.
I was totally prepared to be on my phone and annoyed and whatever. Child, I was about to throw my shoe at Al. He was preaching so hard. I was like, I need you to just preach all the time. Just
you
be
know
a
what's
preacher.
Interesting about Al when he preaches? And even yesterday, I saw a little bit, like I saw a tail bit of it, and I saw he was walking out to the car. I guess somebody was going to go to the cemetery. Like, his whole demeanor changes.
Yeah.
Like the guy you see on TV, like, there's like a way.
In you only, see the connection in it, right?
Yes, but sadly, and then I don't mean to disrespect any non-black listeners that we have, but like, there's a certain way that a black pastor kind of moves.
That's the Holy Spirit. That's that anointed.
But I mean, even
the cadence, the way they walk, all of that.
Afterwards, it's the way they just, it's just a thing. It's a thing.
Spirit.
I can't describe it unless you see it.
But it's like a ball player. It's a certain swagger.
Exactly.
That other people may have, but it's different. And like people, because our rhythm is different, right? And even with that, like, you know, he got to the point where he was like, and he got to that with the organ and all that, standing up. Al preached that thing, and Kurt Carr, who is one of my favorite gospel composers, was handling the music ministry.
I think Kirk is from Houston, right?
He might be. That would make sense.
He is. I know him. Yolanda Adams from Houston.
Yolanda's from Houston.
I think Kirk is from Houston. I'm almost sure.
So that would make sense. Kirk Carr did the music ministry. So listen, it was a very black service, but I really have to say, and I know it sounds weird when we say stuff like this, but it was a really well done service. Like,
okay.
Everybody who got on, everybody who took the pulpit knew how to motherfucking act.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, their messaging hit the right points.
Yeah.
The worst part about it was that black people don't never leave the way the funeral directors tell them to leave want to wait for the family to walk out first. That was the worst thing I saw.
That's never happens.
Ever. Not never. And we all know better.
We all know better. It's going to be a whole glut of people and you ain't going to be able to get through and people shaking hands and hugging.
Right. So, but yeah, I was really moved, and I think one thing that Al said that I think is really important that I think a lot of us have been echoing is, you know, what I said at the beginning of the show, which is that this is the beginning, right? Like, we have become, even those of us who remember the day before digital, we've become very used to rapid turnaround in all things, right? Like, you order something, you want it delivered in a matter of days.
You're on Amazon, you get it the next day. Yeah, that same thing.
You do something on the internet, you want an immediate action. You press a button, this thing happens. Movements take time. Sometimes they take years. Change is not, quick change is usually not sustained change. So like, and I think that is one of the biggest, and this is not a shot or a diss to younger millennials at all. It's just a difference in how we view things. Gen X, we kind of learned that, like, the system is going to be what it's going to be. We got to just work within it and do whatever the fuck we're going to do under the radar. That was the way we moved. Like, we weren't necessarily trying to, like, dismantle anything. It was like, all right, my boss told me to do this. I'm going to do this. Yeah. I'm going to let them think I'm doing that.
I'm going
to go over here and do this. Same thing with parents. My parents told me to be here. They ain't going to be home till 9:30. I'm out over here. I just got to be home before they get back. So we didn't necessarily try to dismantle systems, and we didn't even necessarily fight systems. We were just like, I'm going to be subversive with my shit and just. Whereas the newer generation is very much like, burn everything down and build it back up.
Tear it down to zero.
Tear it all fucking down. Rebuild it. Which for us instinctively is like, y'all talk too much. Just do some shit. Like that, and that is really kind of the difference between us, right? We really just be like, just what are we going to do? Just fucking do. Why are we having, why is it a fight? Why is it an argument?
Why is it meetings about meetings?
Why is it a Twitter thread? Why is it a hot take? Why is it an op-ed? Yeah, why is it a think piece? But it's just a difference in how we view things, because their thing is, if I don't like it, I'm going to challenge you on it and ask you to change it. Whereas our thing is like, if I don't like it, I'm going to swallow it and I'm going to do what the fuck I'm going to do anyway. Right? So it's just a difference in philosophy. But I think the thing about that difference in philosophy is that for us, we're like, okay, we're going to take these certain steps and items, and we have more patience with watching things grow eventually. Whereas they're like, nope, not hard enough, fast enough, strong enough. And I mean, there's merit to that, right? Like, they're less, I guess, complacent about the movement that they see in response to protests. And I do think there's something that we could learn from that. But already we have seen, you know, Minneapolis saying they're going to dismantle their police force, even though that's really just rhetoric. They're going to just put another kind of law and order body in place.
The whole police reform thing. Cause...
Yeah. And you know, we're seeing, you know, the you know, New York passed a no choke bill, but like, is that enough? So we're seeing some reform measures being passed, but some of them feel symbolic and some of them feel inconsequential. But ultimately, they're a start. That's really kind of what it is. They're all just a start.
Bro, what you got to say about the reform thing?
None of these things have teeth. They are all going to be at the discretion of how these rules are applied. Okay. The chokehold is the chokehold dates back to shit. Anthony Baez, maybe even Michael Stewart.
Wow. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, we're talking about like, this is not, this is on the books. So the problem we have here is that we have the letter of the law and you have the spirit of the law. And what you're not teaching is the spirit of the law. And you can't really teach that, because in order to teach that, a person has to understand and recognize the humanity in someone else, that they don't, that even as, even if they are a criminal, they are not deserving to die. And you can't teach that to someone. There's no amount of training that is going to put you through a course that's going to make you recognize someone's humanity. Yeah. So all of this is for naught. And I don't want to seem like, you know, this sort of pessimistic, you know, bad guy who doesn't want to see change. But what I want to see is, how about we just actually enforce the rules that we have? How about we start there? How about we start with doing things like stopping changes of venue when NYPD is being, you know, when they have to go to court.
Trials and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, because that's what happened with Amadou Diallo. They took that case up to Albany.
Yeah.
Where they're going to be obviously least likely to get people who are going to have bad feelings
about police.
Excuse me. Or resentment because of their treatment of those police. So yep. I say all that to say, all of this reform, it sounds great, right? Like, so we have 50A, which is basically like this enacted reform where police officers that have these sort of really violent and sort of bad histories, you know, police records, that they'll be able to, you know, we'll be able to go online basically and kind of see what that is. But we know what that's going to be. That's all determined by someone inputting that up to that system.
Exactly.
So this is all
a police person.
Even if it's a civilian, it's a police employee.
Exactly.
There's no, the reality is that there's going to be no way around making someone recognize and operate with a level of transparency that is going to be needed in order for this bill to have teeth. We're going to have one or two issues that we're going to be able to relate to this bill, and in that case, that will kind of make people feel like they have won, you know. But you know, look, and I'm not a New York City resident, so obviously she doesn't speak for me. But for AOC to act like this new, you know, air quotes, this new chokehold ban is some sort of victory, like, that to me is just very. It's a little tone deaf, to be quite honest. Like, it's a little tone deaf. It's like, this is not a victory. We're basically asking them to enforce what we already know. Like, all of these things have been established. What are we talking about here?
You know what I think a huge issue, and it's semantics, but it's causing a lot of issues, is when because that happened with me. When I heard first time I heard defund the police, I took that as, oh, they want to just wipe the police out. And obviously, that's not what it is. It's not that.
It's about reallocation of resources.
Exactly. Moving money to more social programs. And
let me just say, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I think that the fact that you thought that is really a problem with the messaging.
With the messaging. You know why I think, and people have been talking about this all week. The thing is, I think that people were looking for something that's, you know, and this is part of the challenge when you're doing internet-based social justice, is that you have to have bite-sized, hashtagable slogans, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, reallocate police budgets don't sound as catchy as
defund the police,
or, you know, differently fund the police, or, you know,
move that money around. All of those things.
Yeah, move that dough. You know, like none of that. It just doesn't sound. But to your point, part, and I was having this conversation with somebody, like, the great and terrible thing about the internet, and I think we've talked about this in several different capacities, is that on the one hand, it gives you room to amplify your message much further and much more quickly and bring more people along. On the other hand, it allows less opportunity to actually drill real messaging into somebody, right? Like, you have to have them in bite-sized bullet points, which people may not even read. People read the hashtag. Well, they post
exactly. People read the hashtag, or they read the title of the article.
The graphic. They might not even read the graphic, whatever.
And they just go in. You know what I'm saying? So
right.
Yeah, and so, that's a huge problem.
And that's a challenge, and it's not even really, you know, it's not completely organizers' fault. Like, how do you, it can be hard to balance, like, that messaging in a way where it's shareable and digestible, but also, like, conveys everything you want to convey. And I think that's something that we're especially seeing as a challenge this time around, when people are, you know, confusing all types of shit, like, people who aren't organizers are taking over marches, and, you know, folks thinking that Antifa, which is not an organization, by the way, Antifa exactly. is a philosophy. It doesn't actually exist as an organization, but like just the miscommunication this time around is on 100, which also concerns me, because I already knew we had a lot to face as an election year, but between Corona and this shit, like, people's either unwillingness to take an extra step to do research, right, or just assumptions in spreading whatever they find, it's bad.
And I've also seen a couple people, look, I'm not trying to cape or anything, but when the clip of the mayor of Minneapolis, when he got, you know, booed and he walked away, and everybody was kind of like, get out, you know, it was, you know, because he walked away like a little school kid who had jokes, I get it. But I paid attention to what the woman asked him. She asked him, are you going to defund the police? And then she said, we don't want any more cops. Mm-hmm. We don't want anybody with guns. And that's why he was like, no. Like, that's what, like, Minneapolis has a metro area of 3.5 million people. Like, you get that. Right. Their police force obviously has a lot of fucking issues and have been brutalized for years. I didn't even notice until George Floyd thing happened. So they got a lot of shit to fix. But to act like we're just going to take them away. And then I saw Michael Denzel, something. He's a writer. I saw him on MSNBC over the weekend. And he was like, yeah, like, we should, like, people should really police themselves. And we should have, like,
that's
no, the messaging that's, ain't
that's,
even right.
No. That's utterly foolish, and it's nonsense.
And your man was right with it.
And you know why? Because this is what we talk about with. All you need is a few chimes of yes, and people start going off on it. Like, let me give a little clarity. Camden defunded the police.
Yes.
Camden, New Jersey defunded the police. But what Camden did and what New Jersey uniquely can do is that they were able to use sheriff's departments, and you can have shared resources.
Ah.
There are towns in New Jersey that are incredibly close. Like,
yeah, like, they're on top of each other.
Dude, you can drive 4 miles and be in three different towns during that 4 mile drive, right? They all operate independently of one another. And so when you talk about a town of, you know, 75,000, you know, you may be talking about a police department of, you know, what are we talking about? 100 people, 120 people,
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about you know, 9 to 11 square miles. That is not nearly the same as a city like Minneapolis, which is 500,000 in population, 58 square miles of logistical mapping that you need to operate on. Like to just simply disregard and say that the police are not needed is a foolish matter. It's a silly stance. However, to say that they need to reallocate those resources because the data is showing us that police are showing up to domestic issues where there are people with mental illness or significant other issues. They are not equipped to deal with homelessness, to deal with people who are, and this is what we see a lot of these issues are. Right. Like this is where a lot of the issues stem from, is that their response is in an aggressive way to a non-aggressive issue or call. And they're saying, hey, if you took $40 million from this budget and allocated it to where people can go out and say, you know, go to the you know, person that's on the corner that may be having an episode, maybe having a breakdown, and get them some help and get them the access that they need, we're more likely to have police doing real police work, less likely to have people who are in volatile situations that just need some professional help, you know, get, you know, tased or shot or killed. You know what I'm saying? Because we have, take the people in Miami. The guy in Miami gets shot because he's trying to talk to a kid who is on the autism spectrum.
Mm.
Right? Because if you had an organization or if you had a department that was dispatched for that particular thing,
they would know how to handle that.
Nobody's shooting at that kid.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not a threat. Your assessment is very different. Your assessment is always very different. So,
number the question: does the Camden defunding and making it sheriff's money, has it worked? Has it worked positively, or is it still too early to tell?
So far, it has worked positively. And kind of back to that, I went off on a tangent a little bit, but kind of back to that. I mean, ultimately, what it does is, you have sheriffs and you have neighboring police departments that you're able to use. And what will happen is that ultimately those sheriffs kind of become the police regulars in those spaces.
Okay.
So what I was trying to mention, and I kind of went off, was that the scale in comparison of Camden and a major metropolitan city is not the same. It's not a comparable scale. It's the way people say, well, they do it in Sweden.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, Sweden is like the size of Texas. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, what, you know if what I'm that. Saying? It's, I'm like, not even square mile. I'm just saying, like, maybe even the population. I'm just saying, it's like, it's not comparable.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't have 300 something million people. They got like, you know, it's, they got so, like 9 million.
So the whole, I'm just saying the defund the police is an accurate way to really kind of lessen the contact that I think police have with people. What it doesn't address and what it doesn't do is hold people accountable for the contact that they do have. You know what I'm saying? Like, my issue here is, when are we going to address the fact that these unions are holding these fucking municipalities hostage?
Hostage.
And they are running roughshod and operating in a fucking Gustavo type way, man. Like, yep. I don't understand why nobody is putting the onus on these unions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The union shit is insane. I mean, you see, right here in New York City, you see what it is. It's like, you know, the head of the police union is just does whatever the fuck he does and says whatever he wants to do. Disrespects any other authority because he can. They got a, you know, the police force here has a budget of $6 billion. So, like, you know, they're like, yo, it's our city, and fuck
and,
you.
And
this is why you see that speech yesterday, because that's really how they feel. It's our city.
I would also like to add, $6 billion is an enormous amount of money. However, we are not going to pretend that New York City is like every other city in the States. Like we definitely not going to do that.
It ain't Little Rock, Arkansas. You
know we are not going to do that. Right. We are not going to pretend like that $6 billion is not because that is not all city money. Remember, they get federal money for a lot of the anti-terrorism. You know, New York City also, if I'm not mistaken, New York City operates as a training hub for other police departments to kind of come in and sort of deal with that sort of anti-terrorism, which is why I was so surprised that Buffalo had a 57-person emergency response team.
Yeah.
In Buffalo, I'm like, what the fuck? I mean.
Yeah, yeah. What's going on up there?
You need what's going on in Buffalo? Ain't nobody coming up there to blow nothing up in Buffalo. My nigga, like, relax.
Word. Let's give me some wings and let me get the fuck up out of here.
To give you some comparison, New York's ESU unit is 400 people.
Wow.
So that's not, I mean, we're talking about massive, you know, massive hot targets.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Yeah. I think a big part of that budget also comes from the federal government. I'm not sure what that number is, but I'm sure it's huge. But yes, the city can absolutely take some of those funds, start to reallocate it. No one has a problem when they take funds from social programs. No one has a problem when they close community centers. No one has a problem when they defund schools or reallocate funds from schools because they're, you know, fucking gerrymandering and doing all of this shady shit with the guidelines for who can go to schools where. So, you know, they'd be all right. If they had a budget of $5 billion, I'm sure they'll be okay.
They'll be, you take a billion away from them.
I'm sure patients will still be paid.
Word.
And the break room is still going to have water.
Exactly.
Like, relax.
And a ping pong table.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to just mention before we wrap up, just got to mention Terry Crews, man. The habitual
Terry
line.
Just can't get right. God bless him.
Terry.
I need him to get with a real communications team who works in activism and social justice immediately, if not soon.
Nah, he need a real nigga that's a friend. That's what he need.
Yeah, because right now, I don't know if it was you or not, one of y'all said that you could tell that he just run everything by his wife, which is fine.
But it was you, right?
But it's fine to have your wife be your wife should be your best friend. But you also need another person who's not your wife, like you said, like a nigga to be like, bruh, what the fuck, man?
And when I say best friend, I mean, so listen, Terry makes these comments about black supremacy and which are just, it's actually ridiculous when I say it out loud. Like, it's as ridiculous to read as when I hear myself saying it out loud. He makes this, you know, he does this all we are the world, we all together, kumbaya shit. And ultimately, he's fried for it.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. And this is kind of on brand for Terry. You know, Terry has a history of kind of doing things like this. He threw Gabrielle Union under the bus most recently. And you know, doing what we talked about, which is, you know, not recognizing the fact that even if it's something that may not be happening to you, to at least acknowledge that black people go through this.
Yes.
And he pretty much dismissed her statement. So go ahead now. You on mute?
I was just going to say, this time around, it wasn't even that bad. He just went left because the motherfucker cannot take negative feedback. This time, he actually started on the right foot. So Odell Beckham Jr. and a group of NFL players did a video that was basically like, I am Trayvon Martin, I am George Floyd, yeah.
I am
Breonna Taylor, mm-hmm. etc., and called the NFL out. I'm actually surprised I haven't seen more chatter about it. Called on the NFL directly to speak out against racism and against, like, injustice. And Terry initially retweeted that and was basically like, you know, as a former NFL player, you know, saying that he faced discrimination and racism and that he was proud of the guys for using their voice. But then the tweet after that, I actually believe was an appeal to white people, and he just didn't know what the fuck he was saying, because he was saying doing work on racism without white people creates black supremacy, whatever. I just think he was being ignorant, but I feel like he was trying to go in the right direction, saying that, like, based on his previous tweet, saying that, like, white people need to be, right, saying that white people need to be part of the solution, but obviously, since black supremacy is not a thing that exists, he got called out, and I think people also didn't see the previous tweet. He didn't thread it. So they would assume Terry was just being Terry.
Yeah, I didn't see the previous tweet either. I just saw the
right, which he was still. Because I went to his page, like, where did this even fucking come from? So then, because he got negative feedback, all of a sudden,
he dug in.
As he always does, he dug in and doubled down. And we're probably going to get an apology about how he learned and he realized his words were harmful in, like, the next 24 hours. But, like, I'm over it. At this point, this is, like, the fourth cycle we've been through on this with you, bro. Like, it should not, this should not be a thing that keeps happening.
Terry strikes me as, and Terry strikes me as a guy who doesn't have a lot of friends. And I don't mean a lot of friends like plentiful, but I mean friends like close friends, like people that really check you to be like, yo, you bugging my nigga. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
doing a lot.
Yes. And I think he has and does operate in this. I only, you know, my wife is my best friend. I only go out with her. I only do, you know, and so he is isolated.
Yeah.
And I really think that he is, you know, probably going to work, going to set around a bunch of white folks. And because, again, his experience is one of them being nice to him. Mm-hmm. The assessment and the assumption is that this can't possibly be happening to you.
Yeah, things have changed. Things are good because I'm going to work through the suite.
And it's like, yo, dude, like, you know, it's. Also, it's okay to sit some things out. We talked about this last
week. Absolutely.
No one, I assure you, no one was tweeting, what does Terry Crews have to say?
Where Terry Crews at on this? Where TC at on this? So, Terry, bro, sit your ass out. The Gabby thing really just, you know, burned a ton of bridges. He tried to apologize. Nobody was trying to hear that shit. Because, again, like Max said, even on that, he doubled and tripled down before he realized, okay, I'm fucking up here. So it's like the fourth incident with Terry. Terry needs to just stay off the Twitter. You know, just lurk, read some shit. But we don't need you to chime in on nothing.
And I want to say something, too. One last thing on this is like, yo, Terry gives enough fodder and enough material for you to make your point and make your views about him. Like, there's no reason to go into the photoshopping shit. There's no reason to, like, you know, talk about the whole sexual assault thing. I don't talk about his wife. Like, that shit is unnecessary and uncalled for. Yeah. And that's just not okay.
Yeah, yeah. Just talk about he gives you
enough material with the issues at hand.
Get at him with no problem. So that's it. Yo, stop the opposite and less and less masks out there, man. I'm like, you know, it's to the point now where people look at me crazy because I am wearing a mask. you know, like, what are you doing, nigga? Like, why you got a mask on? So please, like, a lot of states that opened up early, their numbers are spiking now, not surprisingly, because everybody thought the shit was sweet. So please wear your mask. Still try to social distance. You know, as much as we're going on, like you said last week, coronavirus is not over. And ain't close to over. People are walking around here like it is, and it's definitely not. So please, you know, wear your mask and try to not get other people sick.
Before we log off, I have some, I want to give kind of like a sad acknowledgement that's been confirmed since we've been on taping. A former guest on the show, associate to all of us, she hasn't lived in New York in a while, so we haven't seen her in a while, but Jazz Borders has apparently passed away. And we just wanted to acknowledge that. You know, she was young. She was young. I don't know exactly how old Jazz was, but she's definitely younger than me. Started her career as one of the, you know, early influencers of, like, the music blogging era and early, like, video content for music blogging era. Mm-hmm. Really well respected for her voice and was in LA in the writer's room of This Is Us. And I think she actually was at least credited with the concept. I don't know if she was a screenwriter on, but when they made What Men Want, the reboot with Taraji, I think that was Jazz's pitch, at least, like story.
Okay.
So she had been, you know, doing her thing out there. I don't know details. We don't have details. I'm hearing a few different things, but she'd been very public with some struggles she'd been having lately. But at any rate, you know, we wish her a safe journey, you know, to the other side. We hope that she's at rest and at peace. And we send love to everyone who knew her, whether in person or just followed her in terms of her career. Because I know a lot of people definitely looked up to her as a source of inspiration. Absolutely. Fierce fighter, very determined in everything she set out to do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bless Jazz and her family.
Yeah.
And that's all. We're going to wrap up on that note. We'll see y'all next week. Safe out there.
Yeah.
Keep up the good fight. And we'll see y'all next week.
Peace. Later.
And that's what's popping in the world of entertainment. Thank you for listening to the Pop Life Podcast with Jeffrey, Naima, and Sean. Want to be a part of the show? We've got three ways you can get involved. Like us on Facebook. Send us your burning questions to poplifepodcast@gmail.com. And follow us on Twitter @Pop Life Podcast. Talk to you next week.